Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
From the blackest corners of your mind, they call, pulling you deep into shadow, twisting your senses, keeping you from sleep. It's time to face your darkest fears. This is Tales to Terrify.
Good evening, children of the night, and welcome. I have a little something extra to share with you today. At the end of last week, I had the opportunity to sit down, remotely, with John Palisano, the president of the Horror Writers Association. We talked about the Stokers, about the association itself, and about horror in general. It was a great conversation, and I'd like to share it with you here today. If you'd like more details about the Stokers, the Horror Writers Association, or John himself, I'll post those links in the show notes. Children of the Night, join me for a conversation with John Palisano.
You guys must have a lot on the go trying to get everything figured out with the things being so crazy in the world right now and trying to figure out what's happening with a pretty major event.
Yeah, we are definitely trying to deal with writing a very big ship with many moving parts. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the convention, it's all the different aspects of the convention. It's, you know, if you know anything about StokerCon, it's like five conventions running at the same time with, you know, different figureheads running each section. So coordinating all that and doing it intercontinentally is, man, you know, it's a lot. So, yeah.
Oh, I bet. The first time you're hosting it in the UK, something really exciting and different to, holy crap, now it's an entire new set of logistics to try and figure out.
You know, getting to the point before even the coronavirus came out, just getting all that coordinated was a lot. Because again, we have like, you know, authors coming in from around the world, and we have the Final Frame Film Festival with filmmakers coming from all over the world. You know, we're doing Horror University and then local programming. And we finally had everything just about ready, and then kabooey.
Right, so, near the finish line, eh?
Yeah.
So close.
Well, the really good news is it's looking very likely that we're going to be able to postpone. I don't want to publicly say any dates or timeframes yet because we're waiting on the hotel's confirmation, but it's looking really good. The other thing we want to make sure of is if we do postpone it and we're still in this situation in a few months, that we can postpone it again. So we're all trying to make sure that can happen and everything can be carried over.
That's a lot to figure out.
It is. And if I may say, the biggest thing I'd like people to know is the HWA is not abandoning anybody who is going to attend. We're definitely going to try to work with people with their schedules and try to help them with their airlines or their, you know, hotel reservations and stuff like that. So we're going to help any member that needs that help. We're going to do our best just so people know we're not just like, hey, guys, sorry, you're on your own. Bye. See you next time. No, we're not, you know, we're all a family. So and everybody coming, we appreciate. So definitely going to be doing our best to help facilitate any changes for people.
So how many people are at the World Writers Association? How many staff do you have?
Well, we're mostly volunteer run. I think we have over 50 people in different aspects all over the organization doing different things, at least, including the officers, including people that are volunteering on the juries, things like that. Yeah, it's small things and then big things, you know, on up to, you know, all our board of officers and trustees who do a lot of the heavy lifting. And the StokerCon team is its own unit as well of 5 different people. And then all the different trees that splinters off into.
We've had the privilege of, you know, for years now, we've reached out pretty much every year to the individual nominees, particularly in the short story category, because that's kind of our jam, to feature their stories on the podcast. And that was back from years and years ago when this was started by Larry Santoro.
Ah, bless his heart. That voice.
Yeah, no kidding. And, you know, I think Larry's involvement with the HWA really kind of paved the way for one of the things that our listeners look forward to most every year with the podcast, hearing the Stoker-nominated stories. You know, there have been last year, for example, we were a little bit late on the uptake. We had some ownership changes and that sort of thing. And there were quite a few people that actually reached out asking when or if we were still going to feature the Stoker stories. So I think that's kind of a testament to the awards themselves and, you know, what they do. I thought this would be a really good opportunity, though. I'm not sure how many listeners who haven't either attended the Stokers or who are, you know, aren't HWA members really know that much about the Horror Writers Association and what you do. So I thought this could be maybe a really good opportunity to get a bit of a peek behind the curtain to see, you know, what you do, what your mandate is, and why you exist outside of just the Stoker Awards. You know, it's been an amazing event, I think, to help rally the horror community, but you guys do so much more than just the Stokers.
Yeah. Well, I think that the HWA definitely serves a lot of different people now than it used to. We've worked really hard to include not just authors, but librarians and academics and publishers and comic book writers and screenplay writers and producers of cinema. And that's been an amazing situation. Oh, and game, video game and board game creators are also coming into our fold too. You know, anybody that's writing horror in one way or the other. We even have horror songwriters in our midst, which is really cool. And of course, poetry and prose and nonfiction we've always had for since the beginning. And I think that's one of the neat aspects is that I always tell people, you know, horror brings us together, but almost everybody has their fingers in many different genres and areas. I don't know anybody that just says, I only write extreme horror, nothing else. You know,
yeah.
they're always like, oh, I did horror, but I'm writing this romance series, you know, or something like that. Or, you know, a lot are into science fiction as well and fantasy. Some are straight literary. And I think as far as what we have to offer, we've also worked really hard because for a long time, the HWA was thought of as an amateur organization only for people just starting out. And we still certainly have that aspect. Where we can help, you know, people just starting off on their journey. But now we're really helping authors well along on their journey, too, in many ways. There's a lot of support systems there for them as far as promotion for their books. There's a lot of professional support with things like the grievance committee and professional opportunities like being able to teach at Horror University. which is great because you can actually make a little coin there.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So there's a lot of great opportunities.
Well, I think that speaks to the diversity of the genre, too. I think that's one of the things that's always drawn me to it is, you know, horror can cross over with so many different things. It touches so many different categories and so many different subgenres and other types of outputs, other types of work. It seems to span so much, and it seems to speak to so many people. I feel like it's almost come into its own even more in the last, you know, decade or so, at least mainstream. I don't know that many people that don't enjoy a good horror movie now and then, whereas it feels like it used to be a little bit more niche. Have you found that to be the trend, or do you think it's been pretty consistent?
It's absolutely been the trend, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. I think, A, it's become a very scary world for everybody.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, and for people of all ages and all walks of life, it's a very scary, unpredictable, unsafe world. And I think it speaks to people, the genre of horror, in a way that few others do, and where you can kind of work your way through these fears and find ways to conquer them and empower yourself over them. And I think that is really something that has been a really valuable asset. We're seeing a big upswing in young kids coming to horror and coming to like our library events. We're seeing kids like 8, 10, 11, 12, and they're dressed as, you know, Stranger Things. They're dressed as the characters in Stranger Things, and they're dressed as Pennywise. And I'll talk to them and say, you know, what draws you to this? And they're like, well, when I go out with my friends, you know, I never know what's around the corner now. And when I watch Stranger Things, I feel like those kids are like me. You know, or when I watched it, I felt like, you know, those kids were like us, you know, and there is scary people like always waiting to come after us. And I'm like, this is so cool. I mean, that's exactly and precisely what drew me to it as a kid and other generations. So it's great.
Yeah. Oh, me too. I think that mirrors my experience pretty closely too.
Right.
I remember I used to go to the library and get out those like books on tape. And like get a whole bunch of like Stephen King stuff and just go through cassette after cassette while I was supposed to be sleeping, but hiding under the covers and scaring the crap out of myself.
Right.
It's funny. What do you think it is about like scaring the crap out of yourself? Is it the adrenaline rush? Is it, you know, that really, it seems to really stand the test of time as something that we like to do to ourselves. It's a little bit masochistic in a way.
Yeah, I think it's, you get a similar rush, from like extreme sports, like jumping off of a bridge or, you know, racing a car on a street you're not supposed to race it down. I think that's one of the things that really appeals to horror is you can get that in a book. And I think that's a really appealing feeling. It kind of gives you that a little adrenaline, a little bit of a high. You know, you're like, oh my God, I don't believe that. You know, if you're watching an extreme horror film like Saw or something for the first time and you're like, oh, I don't believe it. Ah, and you get that kind of like wound up feeling. And I think it kind of, it can become an addiction in a way. And again, I do think a lot of it too has to do with folks just kind of like psyching themselves up and kind of like working out things. Like you go to a gym to work out to get strong. And one way is I think horror works out your emotions to get stronger in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of the people that are drawn to the genre need that kind of strengthening somewhere, somehow, something has caused them to want to become stronger in the face of fear.
Yeah, feel a little bit, not quite desensitized, but yeah, more comfortable with the concept.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is fun. I mean, the dark stuff is fun, you know?
Yeah, especially when you can explore it in fiction instead of like in yourself, right?
Totally. Several years back when Clive Barker, he was signing one of the first Abarat books. And I said, oh, this is so cool, you know, and this is such a beautiful book and great. And he said, oh, I don't know if the kids are going to go for it. You know, it's so dark. And I said, oh, no, man, the kids love the dark stuff. Think about it. Wizard of Oz. They love the scary parts of that. They're waiting for that. You know, and Balrog and Fantasia, that was like the coolest part. You know what I mean? And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. So I was like, even little kids kind of like that. They like the darker stuff, you know? They a lot of them are drawn to that immediately. That's the fun one, the fun part.
Well, it's funny, too. When you're young, you almost remember the nightmares more than you remember the good dreams, right?
Those are
the
ones
that stick with you.
Totally. Those are the ones you talk about to your friends. Oh, my God, I had this dream last night. I was yada, yada. This thing was after me. Or Jason was after me. And you cut your head off, Billy. What do you mean he cut my head off? You know, should have cut your head off, you know.
So how long have you been with the Horror Writers Association then?
Well, a long time. I know it's going on probably 15 years now. And I started when I first went to my first World Horrors and stuff. I didn't know anybody and I was scared. And there was like all these old guys standing around in circles talking and yapping. I don't know anybody. And I'm like, hi, guys, I'm a writer, too. And they're like, yeah, that's nice. Anyway, this is fantastic literary horror that you should read from. And I was just like, oh, my God, the H.W. Ancients, you know. And but I you know, I met a couple of young Turks, you know, my age. And we kind of stuck together. And, you know, we started like, you know, stuffing goodie bags and getting involved little by little. And honestly, I remember I didn't have money to go to the banquet for the Stoker Awards. So I'd go to the convention, but I'd sit in the back because they'd let you, you know, go in and just watch and sit in the cheap seats in the back. And I'd be so quiet. And, we'd kind of be like whispering jokes to each other. And then, oh my gosh, here I am now. I'm up on stage and I have to address this, you know, crowd of people now. And it's kind of crazy. So now ever since I was a vice trustee and I'd have a table at the things, what I would do is I would go to the back and I would say, they'd say, who do you want to sit? And, you know, one of the funny things is all the officers are like, oh, who are you going to sit with? You know, and the Stokers, who's going to sit with you? You know, you're going to sit with the, you know, the stars. And I remember like 2 or 3 years ago, I'm not going to say names or name the convention, but I had invited people to my table and I'm sitting at my table and none of these people were with me. And I looked over, they're sitting two to a chair at the table next to me because all the famous authors were there. Nobody wanted to sit with me. So I said, the maitre d' came up to me and said, sir, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, go to the back and invite people who couldn't afford a ticket. Come sit with me. and you know, I had a couple of people come up to the table. One of them was Krista Carmen, who I had never met before. And I think that was a really fun thing. And I started that tradition now. And I said, you guys fight over the famous people. I want to go and meet some brand new people first time here, you know?
Yeah. You never know who's going to be famous a couple of years down the road, right?
Right. And it's all about, you know, giving back, because I was that person in the back of the room not so long ago. And I would have loved the chance to come up and like talk to quote unquote real writers and, you know, pick their brains and make those connections, because it's hard. It's scary.
Yeah.
You know, it's anti against, you know, the writer's makeup to go and do these sort of things, to go and be assertive for a lot of them. And, you know, a lot of us, I should say, to go up and push yourselves on people and talk to people and, you know, make those kind of connections.
Yeah, I bet. I definitely fall into that boat, too. So
totally.
I can relate.
Totally.
Actually, I thought it was really interesting. You know, we run a fair bit of Lovecraft's fiction, and just understanding his background, and he pretty much failed in his lifetime because he wasn't able to promote himself. He was, you know, not comfortable going out and kind of shilling his work to people. So,
wow. Maybe that's why he turned out such a great writer, because he was devoting more of his time to that than socializing.
Yeah, true enough.
You know, I swear to God, man, like half the time I'm like, oh, I could go an entire day just answering emails and promotions, and the business of writing can take over so quickly.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I haven't written a word in 2 days, but I've answered about 800 emails. You know, I've talked a lot about writing.
I guess that's one of the struggles with success, too, is especially once it starts to turn into a business, you end up spending more time running a business than you do the things that got you into it to begin with, which is the writing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that old axiom, you know, it's the business is half a show business. You know, and it's true in any of these creative arts. That's the painful truth of it. Very few people get get the work coming to them. Even when you're a Stephen King or you know, an Anne Rice or Clive Barker or Josh Malerman, I mean, they're still having to go out and promote. I mean, King's all over the place all the time still, you know, working it. And it's still vitally important in this era to be a person, be a personality.
Yeah.
And that could definitely, you know, I sometimes feel like I've talked to other writers about this too. And sometimes when you're writing, you actually hear all those voices and you hear those commentaries on Facebook on, you know, what people liked and didn't like in a book or what should or shouldn't be written about. And it changes what you write. And it's a weird phenomena, and it's really hard to turn off.
Yeah.
And it's hard to turn off the business. I know a lot of people who like, what should I write? What's going to be hip in 2 years? What should I work on my next book? Should it be werewolves? Because is that going to be hot? Or are vampires going to swing back around? And you're like, oh man, you know, it's hard to like figure out like in yourself, like how to be genuine in that. And I think a lot of writers too are told, you know, like, hey, I was working with a publisher once and they said, hey, we're looking for such and such kind of book. You know, we wanted to do, you know, zombies, and, you know, zombies are still hot. We want you to do zombies. Then we want you to do a vampire. And I was like, wow, okay, well, how can I do this and still be genuine and not just be riding a wave? And that's kind of that's a challenge.
Well, and I imagine like to do good work too, you know, if it's not a story you're passionate about telling, if it's not a story you're excited about, it's pretty hard to write a really good story if it's just to, you know, to make a paycheck. And I know there's writers out there that can pump them out like crazy that can do that, you know, on request. But I think if you're, you know, if you're really investing a piece of yourself into something that's kind of necessary to get it, you know, to get something really good.
Yeah, 1,000% that. And I think, you know, the metaphorical opening of the vein really has to happen. Even when you're doing like work like that or you know, work that somebody's guided you to or doing, you have to kind of push that away and find the nucleus of the heart of the story and just be real and genuine. You can certainly get there. And it's not like, you know, I worked in cinema and a lot of other things for years. And those are a little bit more guided. And they don't call it the art. They call it the craft in movies. And I never liked that because it kind of said, no, this isn't really an art. You're just kind of a craftsperson, you know, following a template. And I was like, ah, it was such a turnoff to me. It's changed tremendously in movies with the rise of the streaming services. But there were things like you would have outlines if you were working on TV, how many minutes until a break, what had to happen at this minute, what had to happen at that minute. And it was kind of like, it was really kind of soul crushing. You're like, ah, this is just kind of like filling in the blanks. And that's one of the things that drove me back into fiction in a big way. Because although you will get people that will say like, hey, we'd really like you to do zombies, that's kind of the extent of it. You know, they're not going to be like, well, it needs to be in, you know, Mississippi in 1942. And there has to be this, you know, they're not like that specific. They're like, well, we're doing a zombie line, do a zombie. So it's not that bad, which is, you know, I think for most of us, we could think of like 10 zombie pitches in like 10 minutes, you know, if we had to.
Yeah. Fair enough. Hey?
You know, right?
So what do you think is next? I mean, zombies, I feel like we've been riding that wave for a while now. You know, we had that bit of a vampire wave. What do you think is next? Do you see any trends emerging?
Yeah, the biggest trend we're seeing right now is the rise of the folk horror, F-O-L-K. films like Midsommar and the new Color Out of Space adaptation are kind of folk and weird fiction really kind of taking hold. And it's a very different feel, and it's more literary, and it's more traditional cinema style. It's more story-based than monster-based. And that is definitely something that we're seeing in a big way. I mean, Jordan Peele is an amazing example of where horror is going, where expectations are subverted and horror is being used in ways that's never been used before. And I think that's a really exciting change. And I think we're only going to see more of it, especially as these projects, these films and books are really getting a lot of notice and they're gaining a lot of steam. There's a lot of horror fiction now, like The Boatman's Daughter and a couple of books like that. And you know, again, Josh Malerman's books, where they're more like, they're not slasher films and they're not a splatter gore. And I think folks are really realizing that horror is no longer Jason and Freddy and Saw, but it has this amazing ability to make commentary on things. I think that's drawing a lot of people in who didn't think they liked horror until they saw these kinds of projects. And they go, oh, you know, I like this. Is interesting. I really like that Good Omens from Neil Gaiman show, you know, and you realize, mm-hmm. Well, that's horror. And they're like, oh, well, that's commenting on so many great things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool, right? So.
Yeah. Again, I think it speaks so much to the diversity of the genre, too, and how many angles it can take. And like you said, I think there's times where something is horror and it's even debated. You know, I've heard quite a bit of debate around The Lighthouse, for example. Like, is that horror? Is it a thriller? Like, what is that movie? I think that's another good example of that really literary style horror that's drawing people in. Stuff with real depth to it.
Yeah. Well, I think in the case of something like that, it's more a case of a mood that it's making you feel something and you don't know how or why. And that's great. it is making you feel like that same feeling you felt after seeing a horror film. You feel a little icky and weird, mm-hmm. and there was something wrong about that. And that's making you think, and it's making you feel. And I think those are the two things that horror does wonderfully. And if a movie does that, if it makes you feel kind of off and kind of bad in a way, or made you kind of rethink things, then it could certainly count as horror. I mean, Silence of the Lambs, of course, is horror. The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. I mean, Schindler's List, you know, definitely could count as horror. I mean, it's a nonfiction dramatization, but it certainly hit all the marks.
Yeah.
You know, had all the suspenseful scenes. I mean, is Jaws a horror film? Yeah, it's a thriller too, but it's definitely horror. Hitchcock's films, horror films, they're released today, they'd probably classify them as horror.
Yeah, true enough.
So, you know, at the time they were thrillers. So, yeah, it's just really good stuff. Really, really high quality, wonderfully made stuff coming in.
So the Horror Writers Association supports the creation of those kinds of works. And you, like you said, it's kind of expanded what you've included within it. I'm curious, you know, podcasts are becoming more and more popular too. I don't know if you feature much within the Horror Writers Association.
Here's the thing. We've had the discussion with multimedia properties before. The biggest thing that folks want to know is, why isn't there a Stoker category for this, that, or the other thing? Well, we go back to our original byline of the organization, which is we support the written word. So if there's a written word component to it, then we have something. Without the written word, without a script, without a play chart or something like that, it becomes very difficult. It's for the same reason we don't have a Stoker for best cover artwork or best painting of the year. We feel like there's other organizations that are much more well equipped to handle that sort of a thing. But these forms of art are definitely embraced and celebrated in other ways. I'm of the feeling, and this is really controversial. I know I could get filleted by a lot of people for this, but I'm not crazy about the HWA just being known for the Bram Stoker Awards. And there's a good reason for that, because the award is great, but it really is. It's an amazing thing. We get to share it around the world. We get to help support a lot of work that way. But then 6 months later, everybody still has to go out and keep making more work. And, you know, the word's on the shelf, and then, well, get back in front of your computer and write more stuff. You know, I really like to promote things beyond just an award. And I think we're doing things like that with like the Ann Radcliffe Academic Conference and with Librarians Day and with the Final Frame Film Festival. And they have their own kind of awards and accolades that they give out. And I think that that's kind of a superior way to kind of do that. And as far as, you know, podcasts, there's so many great horror podcasts. Larkspur was a great one. I mean, there's been so many. What was it? Night Vale that was out a few years ago. Mm-hmm. All terrific things. And I think that the book that came out around that was actually, I think it might have been one of the finalists that year. The unscripted podcasts, too, are terrific. Like The Ghost Magnet with Bridget from Playboy is amazing. Brian Keene's, we cannot talk about podcasts without talking about their horror show. Everybody's favorite. I love that. Yeah. But I mean, is there a written component to that? It's hard, you know. What do you think? I'd like to hear what you think about that being a podcast, right? And doing that.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, you know, I think the written word component, I think that being a part of your mandate, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it really depends. There's such a, like you said, there's such a diversity in podcasts too, even within the horror genre. You know, ours, I think, tends to be a little bit more of that literary based. I mean, we've had actually, I think, 3 out of the 5 nominees for the short story category this year have recently had stories on the podcast.
Yeah.
So, you know, something like ours is a little bit different in that respect. But, you know, it's interesting, even within the podcast space, there's not really competition. It's like we're all kind of helping to build this big body of work that we love listening to each other, promoting each other. And I feel like I sense that from the horror community at large, too. You know, many of the writers that I've spoken to, you know, everybody wants to lift everybody else up. It's not, you know, trying to get ahead of somebody else. It's let's all do amazing work together and help lift each other up. And I feel like an organization like the Horror Writers Association, because you bring everybody together in that, is, you know, kind of a crucial part of that.
Yeah. And, you know, once in a while, for things like our old iMailer, we were getting people listing their podcast and saying, hey, we have this podcast. I don't see a lot of people sending us stuff to promote. And I would love that. If anybody's listening, please go to our site and send us your stuff. We'd love to promote more horror podcasts. And, you know, we have our blog and our members can promote every Saturday our Facebook feed, which is something ridiculous, like 15,000 people are subscribed to it. Our members can promote there every Saturday and put a promotional post up. Personally, I have seen a lot of results from my own projects from posting to that. And I know others have as well. So I encourage everybody to utilize that. It's a great promotional avenue for podcasts.
So do you find that most of the people, I mean, it's probably hard to tell to some degree, but most of the people you have interactions with or that, you know, participate in the Horror Writers Association or go to the website, is it mostly writers or have you seen an increase in like listeners and readers and other people consuming horror participating there?
Yeah, mostly writers. We don't have a lot of conduits within the organization for things like readers, unfortunately. And I think that's just the nature of it because we're more of a big support system for writers. And publishing and other professionals in the horror genre. And I don't think there's not much there for readers inside. We do see a lot of outside attraction, like we're doing Librarians Day every year now. And we have our Summer Scares program that's going to all the libraries around the country where we promote books and have posters made and everything. We had the Readathon thing a couple of years ago where everybody held up a book and their dog. And even Stephen King took a picture and that went around to all the libraries. So there's some really cool ways that we're trying to reach readers. But the other big thing we're trying to do is when we have our events is to make sure that they're more reader based than, you know, shop based. Yeah. So when we're doing appearances, like we're doing the Festival of Books or something, those are really geared towards readers. And the other big area we're working in is academics and libraries. Libraries have been amazing. Libraries are really doing an amazing job. They've kind of transitioned it. I don't know about your local library, but mine are kind of like these social services offices now, kind of on steroids, mm-hmm. where they have these huge event rooms and stages, and they pay for authors to come in and give speeches, and they do book signings, and they promote the books, and they buy 10 copies for the book of the month. One of our local libraries just had Sylvia Moreno Garcia come, and they rented out this big auditorium for her to do a big talk, and they promoted the book and they made a big display. And you know, it's really kind of cool that they're supporting, you know, authors, and they have budgets. There's a great new festival called Storyfest in Westport, Connecticut that just started 2 years ago. And I was a guest last year and it was phenomenal. This library, they gutted the inside of this library, which is a huge building. And it's like this huge event hall now. And it's like the Ritz or something in New York City. And they have a huge stage with lights and multimedia. And they're getting some big people like, well, you know, Paul Tremblay, Grady Hendrix, Mallory O'Meara were there last year. Ellen Datlow. This year they have Neil Gaiman is going to be their keynote. And this is a library.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Because they're getting like state funds and federal funds and city funds to be cultural centers. So that's one of the things the HWA is partnering on big time, so we can help our authors be promoted there as well and promote literacy. So very exciting times.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing how, I mean, I guess it's a necessary thing to kind of keep up with the times. Not everybody just goes to check out books. I mean, that's part of it, but...
Yeah, talking to librarians out here and stuff, they are moving more towards things like that. Because as we're seeing, you know, social services and stuff, offices collapsing and changing, they're folding a lot of that into libraries. We're also seeing a lot of independent bookstores and big chain bookstores kind of changing. And a lot of that slack is being taken up by the library system. It's, you know, honestly, I'm kind of personally a traditionalist. When I went to the library, my first question was like, oh my God, where are all the bookshelves? And they're like, oh, they're, because there was like four bookshelves in this huge space. And they look more like, you know, decorative kind of things in Gwyneth Paltrow's house or something versus like a real like bookshelf. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, that's all downstairs. And then downstairs look like a traditional library, the first floor, which was my comfort zone because that's what I grew up with. I loved, you know, getting lost in the stacks and it was quiet and, you know, shh, I'm reading. Yeah. You know, now it's like I go to the library and it's like everybody's looking on the phone and they're having the librarians are having loud conversations with people on the middle of the floor. I'm like, oh, my God, what is going on? I'm trying to write here, people. I thought this was a library, you know, but they're supporting literature and they're getting a lot of people in there for other things who are then grabbing books. And, hey, they're going to sit at the back of room and check out Sylvia when she's chatting because, hey, that's cool. I've never seen an author talk before. Yeah. And they're going to grab the book on the way out and check it out. So A plus in my book.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. The smell. That's what I miss is like the smell of walking into the library, just being surrounded by all the, like that kind of sweet, musty smell.
There's few things better, especially on a rainy winter day.
Oh, no kidding.
It's like the best thing in the world. You're like, okay, just everybody go away. I don't care about anything else. See you later. And they got the new Stephen King, so bye.
Yeah. I don't know. Is there anything else that you kind of wanted to share with the listeners, either about Horror Writers Association or about any of the things you do?
I think the biggest thing to know is that HWA is our members' organization. It's not mine. It's not the officers. It's for them and it reflects them. And my door is always open, president@horror.org. And I want to reflect what our members' needs are, not what mine are, what I think they need. And I think that's a really important aspect that a lot of people don't realize. Through feedback, I mean, we even got a new Bram Stoker category a couple of years ago because we needed a short nonfiction, which we were missing, which was weird. So it's everybody's organization who belongs to it. And I think that's something to remember. That's how I feel it should be run. And I think that we're all in this side by side, not on top and below each other.
That's great. I really appreciate you taking some time. Like I said, I know your schedule is probably pretty busy, so... It's to get a chance to chat and
just
learn more about the HWA.
Yeah, well, thank you, Drew. I mean, I appreciate your time as well. It's definitely a very different world at the moment than it's been. So,
no kidding.
It's unprecedented and weird and man, but we'll get through it. And we have our horror books and movies and podcasts to stay connected with through all this insanity. Horror has gotten us through before. It will get us through again.
Yeah. That's kind of that thing that when you finish a good horror novel, it proves that it could always be worse, right?
Yeah, totally.
Well, thanks so much for your time.
Take care.
You too.
Well, children of the night, the hour is late. And we've run out of tales to tell. For now. Support us on Patreon for access to ad-free episodes and bonus content.
visit patreon.com/talestoterrify to sign up. Or if PayPal's more your style, you can support us via the link near the bottom of our homepage at talestoterrify.com. And if you've got a minute to spare, we'd love it if you'd pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave us a rating or a review. Reviews are huge to a volunteer-run podcast like ours. They help keep us on the charts so we can infect the ears of new listeners. Tales to Terrify is produced by Seth Williams, Pete Morsellino, Meredith Morgenstern, Julia Zellman, and myself, Drew Sebastini, with original theme by Nebulous Entertainment. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Join us again next week as we pull you back down into darkness with more Tales to Terrify.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.